Welcome back to the Munich Movie Club podcast. I'm John Kissel, and with me tonight is Shane Settner.
Hey, John. Happy to be here for this fucking stagmire.
Hey, Shane. We got our Gabagool out, we got our Bergeau, we got our Shreya Dell, and I, truly, those were jokes. We don't have Shreya Dell, sadly. What a treat that would be. I have red wine in a juice glass. Shane, what are you drinking tonight?
Well, I have a birrio. Sure. That is Italian.
Sure. Classic and, carm.
And also I have a protein shake to really meathead it up a little bit.
Yeah, classic that guy that bodyguarded Tony for a while in the sixth season after he had his gunshot surgery. God, I can't remember what that great guy's name is. But
he's
yeah.
Fantastic.
Why are we talking about The Sopranos when we usually talk about movies here at the Munich Movie Club? Well, The Many Saints of Newark is coming out the 1st of October, and we all love The Sopranos here. It's a formative experience, cultural experience for me, and we decided, you know, we had never done like a dedicated series of episodes or anything to it, and there are way too many to actually bang out the whole series, and we have a long tradition here at the Media Community Club of starting a series with grand hopes and then petering out, sometimes within two episodes.
More like J.R. petering it out.
Sure.
All right.
Nice. Yeah, fantastic.
Thank
His
you.
Last name is Peters. So what we're going to do instead is we picked a few themes, very broad themes, and drilled it down to four episodes apiece. Four themes, four episodes, although we may not do the whole four themes, being who we are. But our first theme is quote-unquote family. Sopranos, of course, is a show that was sold as hacky Entertainment Weekly ads, if one family doesn't kill him, the other family will. To listen to David Chase, the creator, like this show wouldn't have been made without the mafia angle, even though the lowercase family was what he was most interested in. So we're going to talk about the grabbiest part of The Sopranos first, which is all the mob stuff. But before we get into that and the episodes that we chose to frame that theme, we're just going to talk about The Sopranos in general. For myself, I don't remember exactly when. I think it was the period of time between the second and the third season, which would have been late 2000, 2001, sometime in there. Having read some of those Entertainment Weekly articles in a dentist office or a doctor's office or whatever, my interest was piqued as a 17-year-old or so, and to the library I went for VCR tapes of The Sopranos, two or three episodes, four episodes a pop.
Did you have to like sneak that in under your shirt?
If I remember, the tapes themselves weren't clearly marked. And I also want to say my parents had a see no evil, hear no evil approach to culture at that point with their older children. As long as you're not rubbing their faces in it, then pretty much whatever you watch is okay. So I would go up to their TV VCR combo in their bedroom when they weren't home, and like a younger sibling or four might be downstairs, and I would watch The Sopranos. And by the time I got to college and I had cable for the first time in my life, that happened to coincide with the start of the fourth season, thus started a lifelong love affair with James Gandolfini's heavy breathing. I'm very much a film person, movie person, but I don't have a unique film, TV culture background. I love Pulp Fiction and The Sopranos woke me up to all of the hidden nuggets that could be located in a single work of movies or television. Again, not unique, but it's just true. The Sopranos really keyed me into the idea that everything is purposeful, whether that's because The Sopranos itself is so complex or because there was just so much writing around The Sopranos, who really knows? But it really got me to think a lot deeper about what I was consuming. And it doesn't hurt that from start to finish, with the occasional hiccup here and there, it stayed just an incredible, incredible, compelling, anxious, fantastic show that had a lot on its mind, had a lot to think about, and had a lot to say beyond just the pop culture vagaries of who's getting whacked this week. Shane, The Sopranos, yay or nay?
I mean, I'll just tell you briefly my background with it. I didn't start watching until the episode Chris Moltisanti died.
Sure.
Like a fucking psycho. Mm. I am, which was, what,
That was the fourth to last episode.
So that's when I started watching.
Series, yeah.
And then I think we immediately went back because you lived.
Was it
with
a conscious choice, you watching that episode, or was I watching and you just happened
you
to be in the room?
You were watching it, and I was probably sitting there shirtless drinking a Miller Lite Tall Boy.
Possible.
So does that sound
yeah,
about right?
Yeah, reasonable.
Yeah. So that's where we started watching it then, because I think that season is the one where Flight of the Conchords came on afterwards as
yes.
well. So that was it. I was in. It was a great night, television. Sunday nights.
It was, yes. There was another show in between there. Watch it be Entourage or some shit.
No.
Just really bringing down the overall quality.
Well, I guess Entourage was out then, but I don't remember.
There would have been something else in between. Just these crazy... This period of television, like early 2000s, certainly not the dense, not the quantity that we have now, but you want to talk about like the golden age of television. Like, there was a period where Deadwood and The Sopranos aired at the same time. And if you waited a few months, a season of The Wire would come on. And in the meantime, you've got like 6 Feet Under and Curb Your Enthusiasm and all this other shit. And that's just HBO. So that was a really good time to have free cable in college.
Yeah.
And a DCR and a VCR with a solid timer on it. And lots of blank tapes. I just loaded up a whole drawer of them in my fraternity room. Impact of the Sopranos, obviously this is like the foundational series of the golden age of television. It's not necessarily the first, like you got your Twin Peaks, you've got your ER, like Oz kicked HBO off as like an original, as a space of original programming, original dramas.
I feel like we were both too young for Oz, and I can't imagine.
Oz made it also with the library VCR tapes.
Wow. Yeah. It's like a 17-year-old?
Yes.
That's a lot of, that's aggressive.
I was finger on the pause button. For on the remote,
yeah.
For anybody coming,
and
in.
You just see Oda
and really hoping,
yeah, pausing at a dong.
Yes,
which there's like a 90% chance you were.
Yeah, total. That never any full frontal nudity in The Sopranos. A whole lot of it in Oz, and that would have been a harder explainer than that would be the equivalent of rubbing my mom's face in. At a BC's
dong,
BC's dick. but The Sopranos is the one that really takes off. It gets all the Emmys. It gets all the ratings. It's a total phenomenon. There are still like conventions and tours and all the other kinds of shit that goes along with just any kind of big pop cultural monument that has as intense a sense of place as The Sopranos does. I mean, it was just a few months ago that I went to a theater to watch like a series of DVD extras, like retrospectives about, I don't even think it was, it wasn't an anniversary, I don't think. I don't know, it was just playing. And it was like several actors at a dinner, like Big Pussy and Furio and Johnny Sack talking about their time on the show, and a couple critics, and then those same critics talking to David Chase. And like, that was showing in theaters.
Sounds
and I
lovely.
Saw it, and it was great.
Yeah.
The dinner part was hilarious. It's like the start of the anti-hero show. Tony Soprano is like, his children are your Don Drapers and your Walter Whites and any number of like Showtime or AMC knockoffs that like your Low Winter Suns and Ray Donovan, like those guys. You can do it really well and you can do it really bad, but it's still being imitated. So speaking of David Chase, like, who is this guy?
Yeah, who's David Chase?
Who is David
Tell
Chase?
Tell me more.
David Chase had a shitty mother, much like Tony Soprano. He grew up in New Jersey. His I don't know if he changed his name or his name was changed for him at like a Staten Island. But his original name is De Cesare. He's like a misanthropic character. He doesn't seem to like people very much. He's an incredibly smart guy, but he's not a charming guy. And what he's interested in is really all in the pilot, which we're not going to talk about, but I feel like I came in at the end of something. He just senses decay in everything. I think it's just his mindset, just like things fall apart. His professional background is that he worked on a lot of serialized TV shows like The Rockford Files and had come to a point in his career where he really hated TV. He really wants to work in movies. And you can see a lot of that inferiority complex in The Sopranos. But you can also see that he never would have done this if he didn't have like full and complete control over what yep. got into the show. If HBO had like noted him to death, as I'm sure the Rockford Files did, then it just never would have happened. And the last thing to say about the background is just like this very specific part of the impact of The Sopranos and tying into who David Chase is and how he just doesn't care about people is like the concept of the bad fan, which is like an internet creation. I'm sure Andy Griffith had bad fans. Like, why doesn't he just shoot the town drunk and solve himself a lot of problems?
I mean, you think so?
Probably. I don't know. Somebody probably thought that. Like the bad fan of like All in the Family, who was like, Archie knows what he's doing.
Well, Archie, yeah, he know. He legitimately had bad fans.
Yes, yeah, I'm sure.
But I'm not sure Andy Griffith. Just the town drunk there at the bar. You know what? You should just shoot him. Shoot that guy, Andy.
Yeah, when people in the 60s or the 70s are getting around or getting together at bars to watch the Andy Griffith Show.
Pass me that sarsaparilla. Is that appointment television. From the 60s?
That sounds about right. Yeah, right. Sarsaparilla is like the 70s or the 1860s, sure.
I'll drink it out of my lead cup.
Yeah, they get together to watch Andy Griffith on the television. So what's the bad fan? Obviously, I'm sure we've talked about auteur theory and like death of the viewer before on Media Community Club, where, you know, like once you put something out into the world, it doesn't belong to you anymore. And like the viewer can view it however they want to. However, David Chase didn't give a shit about, he wanted to be accurate, sure, but like he wasn't making the show to load up the body count. He was making the show to like figure out who Tony was and who his family was and how he related to people. And I can remember on old HBO message boards in between seasons, like, oh gosh, Furio's coming back this season. He's going to team up with the Russian and they're going to take Tony out. And like every episode, another character's going to die. And like that shit just never happened. It wasn't what David Chase or any of the writers were interested in.
Well, I can't imagine why anyone would be interested in that. That sounds awful.
It does. It truly does sound awful. Like turning The Sopranos into an action show. These guys are obese men for the most part. We're also pretty dumb. It was just never a possibility. And you still see like Breaking Bad is the other the perfect example of the bad fan. We're just like,
yeah,
Walt's the king, and anybody who gets in his way and stops from doing his meth king stuff is impinging on my ability to appreciate this show, which for me, bad fan is about overcoming emasculation, when the show is actually about masculinity being a trap.
Yeah, it's like that. And I just keep going back to Fight Club in my head.
Yes, sure, yeah. Check out our David Fincher show from a few months ago, where I go on and on and on about how awesome Fight Club is and what I think about it and how it informs my worldview. The Sopranos, I think, was aware of the bad fan and treated them as badly as a show could possibly treat a fan. And we'll talk about this in some of the episodes that we're going to talk about. But you compare it to a show like Breaking Bad, which I think indulged its fans at the very end, and especially a show like Game of Thrones, which was like obsessed with what the fans were thinking and made worse because of it.
Yes.
The Sopranos remains great because they were only making the show for themselves. And if it worked, people watched, great. If it didn't work, I don't think David Chase would have cared at all. David Chase followed The Sopranos with a movie called Not Fade Away, which I think is pretty good, not the best thing in the world, but nobody saw that. I don't think he gives a shit at all. If nobody sees The Many Saints of Newark, I don't think he's going to... I don't think he'll care, because the most important thing is just putting the thing out into the world, and then at that point, you're done.
Does it surprise you that he made that?
The prequel?
Yeah.
He's been talking about it for a really long time. It is a little disappointing that he never found something else to make. He had to just go back to his Soprano stuff, and we're not on a great track record of like revisiting cherished television. Like the Breaking Bad movie was okay, the Deadwood movie was a disappointment. This isn't exactly a continuation of the Sopranos, it's a prequel with like an entirely new cast. So maybe, but I mean, it took him like 86 hours to make his masterpiece, and if he can like cut a tiny chunk out of it, like a 2-hour chunk out of it, and make it as good or complimentary at a minimum, then I don't know, maybe. I really want to be surprised. I think it's like the kid that is playing Tony is James Gandolfini's actual son. I think that's really interesting, but he's never acted before, so who knows.
Like this show though, like he had a lot of non-actors. I think in general they did pretty good in the show. It's not like The Wire where it just is so distractingly bad to have a non-actor playing a role.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, like a lot of these.
I mean, Paulie Walnuts is a legitimate gangster types. At one point, right?
I would totally believe that.
Oh yeah, no, I've looked it up. Like the guy.
That wouldn't surprise me at all.
Yeah,
he had been acting for a long time. Well, he barely shows up in Goodfellas.
Yeah,
long enough to shove a mailman in a pizza oven.
I think that's what it was. He was like on set to consult, and then ended up. Doing some acting. It was great.
Believe that. Yeah, I would totally believe that.
There's like a picture of him on the beach, like totally jacked, like wearing like gangster clothes, kind of. It's great. So look at it.
Sopranos is a good show. That's the point. And we're going to talk about, we're going to talk about its relation to the mafia, its conception of it, its conception of who was in the mafia, what kind of person, what is their day-to-day like. And the episodes that we chose to talk about are The Happy Wanderer from Season 2, Fortunate Son from Season 3, Whoever Did This from Season 4, and Long-Term Parking from Season 5.
I thought you told me we were literally just talking about Paulie Walnuts shirtless the entire time.
If you can squeeze it in as often as possible, then so much the better. And shirtless would include him with a beater on, a wife beater.
Okay, yeah.
Because that's up. As good as it. That's frankly better.
Yeah.
So, The Happy Wanderer... six episode of the second season. This is the episode with the executive game, the Soprano family's high roller poker game. Tony takes it over from Uncle Junior, who at this point in the series is he's just recently been indicted by the FBI. And in between these very fun scenes of members of Tony's crew playing cards. The thrust of the episode is that Tony has a high school friend who owns a sporting goods store, who was also a gambling addict, and finagles his way into the executive game, and it goes badly for this guy, and Tony immediately turns on him. At the same time, Meadow is doing like some kind of fancy high school college credit performance type stuff with this guy Davy Scatino's son. And Tony aggressively involves her in a way that is so obvious he had to know what he was doing. This is one of my favorite episodes. It is a lot of fun, and it's also very sad.
Yes, yeah,
I think is as good a description of Sopranos as anything else.
Yeah, it's the Liquid Terminator is great here, perfectly cast.
Yeah, this would have been a long time after that, but
he's a liquid.
It's an iconic role. Yeah, you can't help it, and he's just the most pathetic piece of shit imaginable. He has to sell his son's car to make a chunk in the amount of 53 boxes of ZD or however many it is that he owes to Tony and Richie Aprile, who is just a delightful present.
He's so great. He's so great,
and. I mean, he doesn't sell his car. He sells his son's car. He's just a piece of shit. He's the fucking worst. Yes. And he is a gambling addict. I don't know. Those types are just empathy tests. Maybe there's something wrong with their brains. Who fucking knows? But they're just the most pathetic pieces of shit that exist in the world. And I say that as someone who has, a weakness for gambling. I get it in an abstract sense. I did almost pounce a rent check because I was gambling too much.
Oh.
I didn't. Oh. It worked out.
Oh, okay.
But still...
Yeah, probably closer to the line than you want to play.
Yeah, it was in your thing.
I can't think of his. What's the dad? The other dad's name.
The other dad.
Yeah, Liquid Terminator. We'll call him Liquid Terminator.
Robert Patrick.
Yeah.
David Scatino. Davey.
Yeah, Davey.
Davey.
Davey. Davey.
Yeah, he calls him Davey. Davey. That takes you to a certain place.
To go back to the acting on the show, it's great that when they do pull, they have really good guest actors in this, or they have legit people playing these. Small roles. And I'm always surprised when I see him show up. And he's... I'm glad they went with someone just talented for that because it made this episode... makes this episode so much better.
Yeah. I'm sure it was calculated, too, to, cast Robert Patrick against type as this guy. But, yeah, a long line of, people to show up for, one or two or three episodes and, small scenes. And then they can get good draws at the Sopranos.
Because if you have someone like Gandolfini can completely dominate from an acting standpoint, this is not just as good of an episode, right?
Not having watched The Sopranos in a long time, him breathing is so comforting.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
And like the calibration of his breathing, you can read a lot into like his snorts and his gasps, and especially the way he starts breathing when he's really angry and is about to blow up on somebody, which he does in this episode. So this isn't the first time it had happened in The Sopranos, but you get in this episode you get an example of an interaction of like a regular schmuck with the mob. And I think with the popular conception of the mob, less and less because there's been so much pushback, is like The Godfather and on one hand and Goodfellas on the other hand, where like The Godfather frames it as this romantic thing. These are noble dudes who have a code of honor, and Goodfellas where they're just like hustlers and brutes and psychos who can turn on you at a moment's notice.
It's like, yeah, the code of honor is a guideline, but you don't. No one is actually following. No one is following
the code of honor. Yes, which is very much the point of Goodfellas. And like, a lot of reporting after The Godfather came out was like, actual mobsters started imitating The Godfather in the exact same way that like, if The Sopranos were real, that they would have done the same. So like, they have this romanticized vision in their head, but they especially and this is going to come up again and again as long as we do these episodes. Like, they're dumb.
Yes,
they're all dumb. Yeah. With a couple of exceptions, and I think Tony is one. And what it means to be a smart gangster isn't that you're a more effective gangster necessarily. It means that you are smart enough to feel bad about yourself. Which I think is the last episode of the second last episode of the series, like, frames him as a definitional psychopath. Where he's like, feels sorry for animals and is prone to big displays of sentimental emotion. I don't know. That always felt too pat for me. I do think he feels bad about what he does. And I do think that's at like the root of his panic attacks, which we'll talk about in the next episode.
I think it's like an arrested development on maturity for them. Like, when...
Sure, yeah. If you can get anything, if there are no rules on your existence, yeah, what's the point of maturing?
Right. So you come in at like a child, you're sorry in the moment, and then you're sorry in the moment, but then... By the end of the episode, because the guy bothered you, you're like, sure, yeah, I'm going to take your whole business away
from you. I think a dumb guy would just do it.
Yes.
Like, someone who's truly didn't care. A smart guy would consider it. Yeah. Like, the episode takes its name from a therapy session Tony has with Dr. Melfi, who is worse than I remember
her
being.
I agree.
I don't know if Lorraine Bracco, who plays her, is, like, putting on a clinical face, like a drier face, or a drier tone. But she's not great.
Yeah, I've less in my rewatch.
Yeah.
But I think maybe it's because I've also seen the last episode, or last couple episodes, where it's kind of like, this is all pointless.
Sure. But yeah, the episode takes its name from a session that she has with Tony, where he talks about how the person who makes him angry is the person who doesn't have care in the world and is whistling down the street. Tony wants to pound their face in. Seeing other people happy would be like... And a finger pointing at Tony, like, why aren't you happy? You have all this shit. You are a powerful man. You have a family that you're not faithful to and you don't really like, but you're not there. You have the accoutrements of happiness. Why aren't you happy? And, like, everybody knows what the answer is, including Dr. Melfi. It's like, it's because you will so quickly turn on your friend in the way that you do here. There's always a lot of... like subtextual motivational questions in The Sopranos, and Tony in this episode addresses it. Like, he knows who David is, he knows what his assets are, he knows what he has, he knows that he gambles probably too a lot, you think?
Like, yeah,
he probably
yeah.
knows that he shows up at Richie's games,
and
and he makes the decision to just not say no to him. He goes through the motions of, this is a bad idea for you. But he still takes his money. And he doesn't, like, tell Chris, this guy's good for this much. If he, 10 bucks is a ZD, okay, fine. 50, maybe not.
Yeah, I think he...
But I think part of being smart for Tony, too, is, like, allowing him this a grown man made a bet excuses that he eventually gives to Meadow.
Yeah, well, I mean, he does... They do... I believe that he doesn't want him involved in this game for whatever reason. Probably because it's going to be... I think he knows it's going to inconvenience him. And if there's one thing Tony hates more than anything, is being inconvenienced, period. Even like, and we'll get back to this last episode, the last episode we watched, but about him being inconvenienced by Chris in that episode. But he's going to inconvenience, like he knows it's going to be inconvenience if this guy gets in his game, because he's going to have to do something about it, because this guy doesn't have enough, right? Mm-hmm. And Tony knows that. That's why he says, it's not for you. But then the guy bothers enough, he's like, sure, all right, whatever, I'm not going to fight it anymore. Because you're inconveniencing me this way. So there you go.
It is very funny to see Davey try and fit in with the urologist, Dr. Freed, a delightful recurring character, and like Frank Sinatra Jr. Like, oh yeah, there's a lot of money in jockstraps or whatever. I got big ideas about how to how to compete with the big boys.
Yeah, although I didn't like, that's one thing, I didn't like Frank Sinatra Jr. here, where it just doesn't really have to do much though, I suppose. So.
Yeah. And the game itself, these kind of stories always have some base level of appeal because there's a lot of money going around. They don't seem to work very hard for it. It's completely amoral. And there's just all their every like sensual need is being filled at any moment. It can't help but look a little bit appealing. And I think it rarely looks more appealing than it does in this episode with just this like seven card stud game that they're playing. And if money is like no object, then yes, 100%, I will stay up 36 hours to play poker with Silvio.
Yeah.
That sounds fun.
Sounds great.
The last thing to say, well, second to last thing to say about this episode is the way that he brings Meadow in. Like, there is just no room for deniability here. He knows they're friends. He knows they practice together. But he gives her friend's car to her. It's just such a crazy move on his part. And ultimately, Meadow had wanted to do a solo, but being in a ritzy, meritocratic, obsessed high school, everybody wants to do this shit for the college boons.
Right.
And there's no room for her to have a solo, but David's son is obviously upset and quits, and holy shit, she gets a solo at the very end because his dad gave his car away because Tony preyed on him.
I think my favorite part of all that is she's not a good singer in this episode.
No, she's not.
She
not
really good.
Isn't.
It's not good. The girl who comes and actually gets the solo is,
yeah, they precede her with like this like opera singer. And yeah. Meadow is, yeah.
That's such a nice touch.
She's going to sing My Heart Will Go On, which I think correctly the show does not include. Last thing for each of these episodes, we might probably not come up with a better segment title, but The Sopranos was often the funniest show on television. Really anything with Uncle June is a winner for me, especially when he gets into like physical comedy. He doesn't do any of that in this episode, but Tony does throw like an offhanded mention about, I always thought when my mother talked about my feeble-minded uncle, she meant you.
It's pretty good.
Tony doesn't mean anything by it, but Uncle Junior reacts. Hilarious. And Silvio's tantrum. Silvio is a murderer. Silvio is not a nice man. But it's really funny to see him freak out.
It's, yeah. Yeah, I think those are, yeah, those two funniest parts of this episode I can think of, just how bad Meadow Soprano was at singing compared to the opera chip. It's so good. And just like goes back, this family just think very highly of themselves, all of them.
Yes. Yes,
and
they do.
And the privilege is like, I just think it's wild.
Away from like the mob stuff briefly, The Sopranos really was, I want to say, like the first instance that I became aware that there were some pockets of America high school students where the most important thing in the world, more for their parents than for them, was like to just get into the fanciest college possible. It remains a completely foreign idea to me. It sounds like an incredibly shitty way to live, and I have read so many articles about how it makes nobody happy except for the 316th administrator at the college
who gets
their salary to do
like all those people nothing. Went to law school with me, and they're miserable people.
What a fucking awful programmed way to live. I just don't understand it. Anyways. Next episode that we chose is Fortunate Son. This is the third episode of the third season. The main thrust of this episode is that Christopher finally gets made And he discovers that basically he was just onboarded into an organization and he doesn't have really any more power. He has extreme responsibilities all of a sudden and is buried under the weight of these thwarted expectations. Tony has a revelation about some of the roots of his panic attacks, and AJ, Tony's son, also has the same we see him edge up to a realization, but AJ would be a great mobster because he's dumb. So he doesn't exactly have the realization. This episode starts with the making ceremony. Yeah, we mentioned Goodfellas. These guys all just know it. It's just in their bones. They know that when someone tells you they're gonna take you to a making ceremony, there's a possibility that someone's gonna shoot you in the back of the head as soon as they open the door. And that's just like one of the many takeaways from Goodfellas, is like to be in this organization is to understand that you can be killed at any moment by the people that you're closest to. And in fact, the people that you're closest to will likely be the ones that kill you, which ultimately for Christopher is the way it ultimately goes. And it is also the way, like, it goes that way for Christopher's wife, as we'll talk about in long-term parking. Janice kills Richie. Like, people that are closest to these people are often the ones that kill them.
Yeah, we're about to...
It's just trust. It makes trust a total impossibility.
Yeah, and Ralphie next episode.
Yes, not that Tony and him were close, but like...
But
that, I'm looking forward to talking about that episode.
Please keep your pants on.
All right, fine. Zip. the ritual itself of getting made is just so shallow.
It's so great.
It's so pathetic. It's like the best these guys could think of. They put on their shiniest suits, and they find a basement with a giant, ugly pipe running through the middle of it, and they set up a little card table. And they do this thing whose only greater meaning is, like, don't betray your friends. That's it. Polly, like, improvises a bit about how awesome Tony is. That's the end of it.
It's so great.
That's the end of it.
I love Polly.
The Godfather doesn't... They don't even talk about being made in The Godfather. And it's not... it is a good thing in Goodfellas, but you never see the ceremony. You see Joe Pesci's brains splattered on the floor.
In a very similar building.
In a very similar,
basement, right?
Yeah. So I don't know that we've ever seen this thing before. I'm sure it's been well documented. This is more or less what they do. It's just so pathetic.
It really is.
It's like, I mean, this is a real thing, but I know about it because of Drunk History. It's like the guy that infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan and found out all their stupid rituals.
Yeah. They just add K's to everything, right?
Yeah. Yes. It's just dumb. And Shane and I are both in fraternities, and like, I have long thought that this all falls apart when someone says this is stupid. Because how can it not be?
Yeah.
So Christopher, he has this great moment, cursed by a bird in the window, whatever. But he's essentially, as I said, he's onboarded. He used to be a contractor who can just be let go at a moment's notice. But now he's a full-time employee, and there are... You know, it's harder to get rid of him. He has benefits now. But he also has the responsibility of paying Polly $360,000 a year.
Jesus.
$6,000 a week, no matter what. Money in his hand, or I'm sure Polly would charge him points. And would never forget anything. And then a portion of that $360,000.
Just nuts.
A portion of that gets kicked up to Tony, who, in a fantastic cut, we see is just like scarfing on cold cuts.
Unreal shot. Strippers. Unreal shot on that. It's perfect.
It's so pathetic. It's all so pathetic.
Like, it's sweet to talk about the bad fans don't see Tony doing that because they're looking at the strippers ogling, right?
Yeah.
All they do is see Tony looking cool.
And you put a note in here. The strippers on The Sopranos. It's anti-eroticism. They are not attractive women. I don't know that there's any better way to say it than that. There's the line in Goodfellas, like, all the women look beat up. They kind of look beat up. They're just incredibly artificial. It's surreal.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's
true. There's just no other way to say it.
I feel like that about...
Eventually... The strippers got more attractive as the series went on. I wonder if that was just like the HBO CEO of tits weighing in. But those first few seasons, there's no better, there's no other way to say it. I feel like the most rabid feminist would be like, I don't know, man.
I'm guessing you don't care to frequent strip clubs either.
No,
but the whole thing always feels like that, whether it's on the show, this show in particular, or in general. It just all feels so fake and I don't know, just surface level. Yeah. And when you think about this show, that's such the least important thing about it. And again, probably a bad fan's like, you see those strippers just kissing each other last night? Holy shit. Kissing each other, women? A lady kissing another lady in the mouth?
Brando's bad fan has a New Jersey accent, of course. How could they not?
You see that lady?
We see a lot of Jackie Jr. in this episode. The epitome. Like the pre-Jersey Shore, Jersey Shore cast member. A true douchebag. We had seen Jackie Jr. briefly in season two. He might have showed up in like the first episode of the season. I can't remember exactly. But we see him most this episode at the perfectly named Ufa Pizza, which sadly is not real.
That's funny.
You can tell on the show that the spacing isn't right. But that is the real pizza place owner, the pizza parlor owner, I should say. Don't disrespect the pizza parlor.
He yells, it's so good. What a line.
Ufa Pizza. That they call OF. Call it Ufa. Why would you abbreviate that? You're not saving time. You're not shaving syllables off. Call it Ufa.
Yeah, that sounds like they're disrespecting the pizza parlor.
Disrespecting the fucking pizza parlor.
I think I note it later on, but for some of the funny parts of this show, or it's like that line right there kills me because it's such a benign line. It's just like it's a nothing, and they say this all the time in this show, like just these things. They're having these regular conversations.
What's likely happening there is that guy probably pays protection, and those mob guys, Benny Fazio and Christopher, probably thought they earned their keep that week by insisting that Jackie Jr. not disrespect the pizza.
Yeah, right, right, yeah. So, but
like we're performing a public service.
Again, these guys are not smart. The things they're saying are so ineloquent.
Oh my gosh.
It's just so funny.
Christopher, there's a chance in the early seasons that he might be smart because he's writing a screenplay.
His memoirs.
Yeah. Finally.
Finally.
But when you finally see his script, it's fucking garbage. It's the worst shit. They're so dumb. I think the show has so much fun with how dumb they are. What Chris can do probably is like run a sports book, which I can't even imagine the unbearable stress of that. Just as bad a way to live as like a meritocratic upper crust teenager with an overbearing parent. Totally unlivable. Just be like constantly worried. Constantly. It's one thing to like watch a single game a week where like you have money on.
Yeah.
That's stressful enough. Where you have money on every game. It's like thousands and thousands of dollars. And
I
don't understand how it works. I'm frequently amazed that they're as good as they are at like coming up with the lines and everything. So they get it right so often, it's crazy.
I mean, there's probably one smart guy in the room telling.
Probably, I would imagine that was like I would imagine that was like the large man in the room.
Yeah,
he was like he probably played football at a previous point in his life, and he like just knows.
He was good at math. Yeah, he's like a center for like an Ivy League school.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Harder to run a sports book or sell Webistix?
Webistix seems pretty easy to me. Pump and dump. into the psychology again. We see a lot of like we see both young Tony have his first first panic attack in one of the many flashbacks that the show does. And we see AJ also have his first panic attack. It's really interesting that like I'm sure your Alan Sepinwalls of the world TV critics just got a lot of paragraphs out of this section because there's a lot going on. AJ's dumb, Tony's smart. Tony is able to like piece together. It takes him a few episodes, I suppose, but he's able to piece together like what it means for Soprano to be a leader and a provider. I think AJ kind of gets there too. Like his brain gets there because it shuts down, even if some part of his brain gets there, even if like he could never like voice it.
Right.
But Tony being like an 11-year-old and seeing like sometimes you have to chop off your friend's finger, a nice man. You have to chop off a nice man's finger to get your wife hot and bothered and feed your family. And AJ, both seeing Tony interact with people who AJ I don't think is like fully conscious ever of like what is going on.
I mean, he was told not to park the SUV over the leaves to the very end.
That is true. But without knowing the specifics of what all these people are asking Tony, I think he does understand that they're coming to him with questions and expect him to have answers. They expect him to know what he's doing. And AJ is a person who knows he doesn't know what he's doing. That's what leadership means for AJ, is like, I know the answer, and AJ knows no answers.
Yeah.
He's smart enough to at least know that.
He's just perfectly average, right?
Yeah, and just like freaking out about expectations is what makes Sopranos fall apart, fall to pieces. AJ factored heavily into like the message board theories. Like, AJ is going to step up this year.
Oh, no, really?
Yes, and at the end of the season, it'll be like a Jackie Jr. scenario all over again. He'll do something stupid, and something else will kill him.
I'm trying to think of like equivalent of. I just can't believe people are saying that. That's wild.
Yeah, there was good reading, but even in my like late teens, early 20s, I knew enough to be like, this is probably not going to happen. these guys writing anonymously on the internet probably don't work for The Sopranos. Sopranos is often the funniest show on TV. Artie Bucco, in a cast larded with Italians. He is arguably the most Italian, including Furio, who has an Italian accent. He's the most gesticulatingest of all of them. A lot of like half circles around his cheek. It's a delight to hear him talk.
I love all the artist scenes.
Artie's great.
He gets better every time.
Artie's great.
He's so manic. Like, I'm mad, but he's nervous, I guess, and that just the gesticulating adds to all of it.
There's that late series episode where he is told that he's a bad host, and that's just like the worst thing you could possibly tell to that guy. Like, he's not a super charming guy who tables are delighting in him coming over every time. Because like, that scene is him working very... He knows these people. He's kind of friends with these people, but he's working very hard to be charming. And the way he does it is, well, with a lot of elbows and a lot of wrists. you got some stuff right
here. Yeah, Syl. Syl coming down stairs. He just makes this great face. Oh, Syl coming down stairs to
he's a born performer.
He's great. He just, like, just the face when he says, he's sitting on half an ass the whole way over here. And Christopher has, of course, like, I wasn't doing that.
No, I wasn't. You don't know how I was sitting. <It's great. laughs> And, like, some aesthetic choices from Carmella. I've never really paid it that close of attention to... It's hard not to, I suppose. Maybe I just totally...
You gotta pay more attention to Carmella's clothing.
Okay.
It's so fun. It's so obviously intentional. This one... She had these teal pants, which are bad enough, but then a shirt with like these it's like a dark shirt with flowers on it, with like this bright teal lining on it. They're both so tacky, but technically I guess they match because the teal and the teal. It's great. It's so great. Then later, she's
wardrobe corner.
I could go on and on about Carmella's outfits. She's wearing this deep red leather jacket over a deep red like button-up shirt. It was beautiful.
I don't even remember that. I don't even remember that.
That's when she went to talk to Autumn's boyfriend.
I have New Jersey wardrobe blindness.
Meadow's boyfriend is going to beat up her dad.
Oh my God. That guy, he was the victim of a macro aggression. Certainly. But come on.
Yeah.
He would have died.
I feel like it was a little out of character if Meadow didn't say, okay, that's enough of that. Come on.
I totally recognize Meadow in these moments. She's picking fights.
Right.
She very much wants the loudest thing possible to happen.
Yeah, it's...
And it's disappointed when it doesn't. So good on Carmella for not, like, taking the bait.
And that dude has not figured out that he's only there to make a point to her family.
Yes.
That's it.
Yes, that is very true. That guy is not a charmer by any means.
No.
He's in many ways, in a show full of pieces of shit, he's a bit of a piece of shit himself, but it's good that they leave it with him having taken advantage of her, because she was taking advantage of him the whole time. And more Shane's wardrobe corner. Oh, yeah.
Anthony's Slipknot jacket.
Moment of the time. Of course. Of course.
Yeah. It's so great. His wardrobe gets great over the years, too. They just keep him... Just like, what's the douchiest trend possible? And they nail it.
I kind of think he's a little underrated.
I agree. Oh, I think he's a great character. He's awful, but he's a great character to have around.
Yeah. I think I would even go so far as to say that the actor was a little underrated. Not in any given moment, like the top 10, top 15, top 20. Maybe it's a big cast on the show, but reliable. I don't think he's ever terrible.
95% of his job is to be clueless, right?
Yeah, I think the show, and I think this is borne out by like his non-career, I think the show knew exactly what they had with him.
Yeah, I mean, it's impossible to cast kids.
Yeah.
Into adulthood.
Certainly true. Our next episode is Whoever Did This, the 9th episode of the 4th season, most famous for featuring the death of Ralphie Cifaretto. It's kind of the brief synopsis itself. Episode starts with Ralph's son suffering an aero accident. He goes into a coma. And
what a great scene.
And Ralph goes through a maybe legitimate, who knows, we'll talk about it, moment of redemption. Ralph being one of the more... they're all despicable. Ralph being one of the more, if not most, despicable characters in his season and a half run on the show. At the same time, Tony's beloved horse, Paiomai, dies in a fire. He immediately suspects Ralph, goes to his house and kills him. In a fit of... Well, he came there to kill him, I think.
Yes.
And then Tony and Chris, who is in the throes of a very bad period of heroin use, dispose of the body. This is a great episode. This is maybe my second or third favorite episode of the whole series. The major question with Whoever Did This is whether or not Ralph started the fire.
Right. I think he did.
I think he did not.
Okay, there we go. There we go. Great job.
I think the show is better if he didn't. Because it feeds into like what we talked about with the making ceremony. Like, this is an organization with a lot of rules. And Tony breaking them for no reason. Tony being at the head of an organization and just like discarding the rules haphazardly makes him into a hypocrite, which is good for the show, I think. Good for its vision of Tony and his vision of the mob. Whereas if he did it, there's some level of justification in what Tony does. Does Ralph need to go anyways? Like, is he just like an execrable human being? Yeah, sure, yeah. Fine. They all are.
I mean, he's doing that. I think it works both ways, because if he did actually do it, then Tony's excusing himself from being exempt to the rules.
Mm.
Anyway, because that's who he is, because it just is inherent narcissism, right?
Yeah.
He's a child.
Bottomless appetite.
So,
do whatever he wants.
I think it works both ways.
There's a repeated like writing technique in the show where characters are lying, but they never come out. There's never a scene after the fact where, like, oh, I was lying the whole time. The epitome of this is the scene at the end of the 3rd season after Jackie Jr. has failed to rob a poker game. And maybe he does here or there. It goes badly. And he's on his last legs. And Tony needs to convince Ralph that he needs to take him out. And they have a conversation together, and every line is a lie. Like, Ralph saying, I tried really hard with this kid. Tony saying, oh, yeah, you did. There's nothing you could have done. Just everything that they're saying is false. And I think Tony and Ralph are consistently like the best liars in the show. Tony's, as you wrote in here, like, Tony's not always so great at it. Like, here, when he has, like, a face full of bug spray, and his face is beaten up and his clothes are ripped, and he's telling Christopher, I found him like this.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's just a question of, like, I can't... You know what happened here. I can't say it. So I barely would even call that a lie. That's just like, we're just not going to talk about this. Whereas in that instance from the end of the third season and many other instances, Tony just shows himself to be really great at lying. You can't really tell in the moment. Like you do. And in the next episode, we'll see a moment where we don't really know any better as a viewer. And we think, well, maybe he's telling the truth. And I think Ralph, for him, he would be almost too good. He's so forceful in his denial that he didn't start the fire that I believe him, even as I know him to be a liar.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it works both ways.
Okay. After his son goes into this coma, Ralph does he has no reason to lie about this here, and he is legitimately affected by it. He's ashamed. He starts a scholarship. He doesn't get, like, good advice from the priest. The priest doesn't say anything unique to him. But just the fact of Ralph being there, I think, is a big step on its own.
Yeah.
He tries to get back with underrated character Rosalie April, who is awesome. I love Rosalie April. Do you buy any of that? I do. I do.
I think
in spite of myself, I like Ralph.
Well, he's hilarious. Well, he's a dickhead. Ralph he's is psycho, but he's a dickhead to all these guys.
It's yes. I think as far as like smart or dumb gangsters, Ralph's kind of smart.
Yeah, I would say.
But he has no impulse towards second guessing in the way that Tony does.
Yeah, I think Tony knew that too. Like, and I think this is part of what plays into it. But, you know, is his redemption...
I think it's believable, but not possible.
I think whoever was writing this scene has dealt with death in their immediate circle. Mm. Because that's exactly what you do when someone dies. That's close to you.
Yeah.
But he actually started to make these changes. Everyone says they're going to do these things, or and you do just things to cope with grief, like start a scholarship, because you feel so bad because you let your son shoot the other son with a bow and arrow.
Sure, yeah. It seemed like a fun game.
I got the rules. It was a good teamwork.
No, yeah. He lost in the sun, I would wager. Yeah. You gotta be mindful of where the sun is if you're going to play the arrow game.
That's why I don't think it's in domed stadiums.
I think it's really purposeful that the episode where Ralph just takes steps to redeem himself. Tony cannot bring himself to a place where Ralph, of all people, could better himself in any way. Because that would, just like the Happy Wanderer, that would be a finger in Tony's face. Like, if this piece of shit can do it, he, like, beat a pregnant woman to death with his bare hands, then why can't you do it? And Tony is, like, fundamentally a lazy person. Like, we see Chris and Polly. Polly talks about collections all the time. We see Chris and, like, all the hard work that he's putting in. Tony has always been at the very top as long as the show's been going on. We never see Tony making collections going, like, door to door. We never really get that good of a sense of what he does. He orders hot dogs and eats them at the pork store or the Bada Bing. And people come to see him. He's just not a hardworking guy.
Right.
He doesn't have the capability for that. To go back to the idea of like the bad fan and where the show could potentially go. Like, again, I think David Chase just knew the whole time that people wanted mob, mob, mob. There's a credibly good arc that very easily could have happened in the rest of this season and going forward, where like Ralph is a very important person within the mob. He's a captain. He is within the circle of protection, and Tony just totally flaunts the rules and acts like a tyrant in this very feudal organization and acts unacceptably. No matter, I mean, on its face, Tony killed Ralph because he burned a horse up, but they chew people up all the time. Like, none of these guys are going to care about that at all. Tony does. He has no good reason to do it. And it sets up the possibility where, like, this is like a civil war within the Soprano family, where it's somehow going to get out. People are going to put it together that Tony turned on people he's responsible for, and they start undermining him, and he either has to, like, exert total control over the family or... who knows? And it just doesn't come up again. Ralph goes away. They talk about it briefly in like a single scene in the following episode. And that's kind of it. As far as like plot, this is not what this mob stuff is not what the show is mainly concerned about.
Yeah.
As indicated by the show, this season ends with not like a big, the inevitable mob war between New Jersey and New York, which does eventually happen, but this season ends with like the marriage breaking up.
Yeah.
And this Ralph stuff, it leads to just a fantastic episode, but it's over when the episode is over. And this is just yet another example of the show just giving a middle finger to these bad fans on message boards, which I love.
I'm completely for any show insulting its own fans.
Yes, it's the best thing in the world.
You should be shamed for being a fan of anything. You should have not just get that invested.
Especially now. The thing owes you exactly zero. So, it owes you the watching experience and then the idea that you might have some input.
The only thing you can be a fan of is our podcast.
Yeah, and that's allowed. And again, we don't owe you anything if you are a fan. Again, we appreciate
with every your group, fandom. Every group of people we've insulted on this show.
It's a big group.
We're trying to get everybody.
Big group. So. The Sopranos was often the funniest show on TV. We mentioned Uncle June in the Happy Wander episode, not having any physical humor. Boy, oh boy, does he have some physical humor in this episode when he falls down the steps after getting popped in the head with a boom mic. Wonderful. anything we also this is not the introduction, but the glorious, the incomparable Nucci Galtieri.
She's just the absolute
who
best.
Is this woman? Did they just randomly call numbers in Italian-American dominated nursing homes and just the weirdest sounding woman picked up and like, you're on our show now?
What a great character.
Oh my God. She's not at her best here, but she can't be anything but like a 4.5 on a 5-star scale.
Right. just... I mean, if you're looking at season one, you hang around Pauline Wall, and his mom's not in that season, right?
I think she shows up in this season.
But this isn't the woman you think it's going to be. Like,
no.
Someone super sweet, but also just this layer of vindictiveness underneath. It's so, so great for such a side character. They put a lot into it, and I love it.
I love Bobby just so impressed with the muffin basket.
Oh yeah.
But they're paying this lawyer so much money and Bobby is so impressed by the muffin basket.
I everything he does is great. He's just such another
He doesn't feature heavily in really any of these episodes, but Bobby Bacalaw.
It's like they realize what they had. They're like, oh, let's let this blossom this last season.
And Chris just saying, I didn't, when he's trying to convince Tony that he's not high as shit. Fun.
Pretty good stuff. Pretty good stuff. Did he ever get any Emmy nominations?
He won for the following season, specifically the episode we're about to talk about.
Okay.
And I think he was consistently nominated.
Okay.
Along with Jim Gandolfini and Edie Falco, and Lorraine Bracco got in there every so often, and so did Janice, the actor plays Janice.
Oh,
Janice is great. I have no bad things to say about Janice.
If I saw the actress, I don't know if I could separate the two.
Yeah, I completely agree. Steve Buscemi was nominated for his one season, sadly. Oh, nice. Just the one season. That always makes me sad. He was only on the show for a season. It makes sense.
Was that intentional?
Correctly. I think they planned to string him along for another year.
Hmm.
But whatever happened. And then Jerry DeMatteo, who plays Adrian, also won an Emmy for the fifth season.
Damn.
For this episode, Long-Term Parking, our last episode.
Which is wild because, you know, she and Montesani have really done much, right?
I think he does a lot of theater stuff.
Does he?
But she doesn't really work. Which, sad. I think he's fine. I think he's okay.
I mean, he's not doing awful. He's like in a commercial.
She would almost certainly be upset about not getting more jobs. But I think Chris, I can't remember what his name is. Michael Imperioli.
There we go.
I think he's able to just like string together a lot of stuff in a way that Jerry DeMatteo has not been. But anyways, Long-Term Parking is the penultimate episode of the fifth season, the The second to last episode of the season is often when the big stuff happens on The Sopranos. That's when Richard Aprile got killed. That's when there was like a major hit on Tony in the first season, et cetera, et cetera. And that remains true in the fifth season. This is the episode where, away from the Adriana stuff, Tony B, Tony's cousin, played by Steve Buscemi, is off in the woods after having killed Phil Leotardo's brother. And this is really coming to a head between the New Jersey and the New York families. But throughout the whole series and going forward from this point, the FBI is kind of always just like lurking in the background. They're fairly incompetent themselves. But they get probably as close as they ever... Well, I wouldn't say that. We see them be as active as they ever are in this episode. They have people working for them the whole time. Various characters that the family doesn't find out about. But they had their hooks into Adriana for a couple seasons now, and it all comes to a head in this episode where one of the piece of shit characters that lurks around her club kills a guy in her office. She tries to help them clean it up. The FBI is onto the whole thing. And they force her hand. They say it's now or never. And she, almost, and we'll talk about it, convinces Chris to come in with her and go into witness protection. But he changes his mind from seeing a particularly sad man in a gas station. And she is killed in a forest.
Yeah.
This is rough.
Yeah.
It's as rough as anything I think the show ever did. And the show is not stingy with its violence.
And I'm so glad they didn't end the episode with her in the woods. It was a good choice not to.
Which... if you're an internet message board, HBO message board lurker, you're like, we never saw her die.
Oh, come on. You had to see that?
Yes, they did. I mentioned the hangers-on, like Matouche. This guy, we mentioned Jackie Jr. earlier. He, like, is a terrible getaway driver in that instance. He would be, if Chris is a full-time employee, unfortunate son, Matouche is the contractor who's just, like, around. The guy that you bring in on like a week-by-week basis who just lingers and lingers and lingers and never goes away. And he like contributes to the death of like two major characters on the show. And I had never put it together until now that when Adriana is trying to like stick up for him, he's a terrorist.
Oh, you've never realized that?
I had to wait until the final season to really figure it out.
Yeah.
Because at that point, like, he's walking around as, like, a fundamentalist Muslim. But the way that she described... That's the funniest thing in the episode. In this moment of high trauma for Adriana. It serves to illustrate what an innocent she is.
Yeah.
Also, how stupid she is.
Yes.
These characters are dumb. She knows what's happening. But the fact that he had a religious awakening a few years ago. This was released in 2004. His brother started a school
right.
in Pakistan. He sends all of his money there. He's a drug dealer.
But he doesn't take the drugs
himself. You can see the FBI guys reacting. I can't believe I never put it together. I'm ashamed of myself.
I'm such surprised.
In the moment, I would have just been like, I was Adriana previously. We're just like, yeah, this guy, we met him as a piece of shit ecstasy dealer. He's still a piece of shit ecstasy dealer, but he's taking small steps in a show where change isn't really possible. But it turns out that change is quite possible for Matouche,
right.
who is, you know, funding some kind of fundamentalist madrasa in Waziristan. Yeah, over my head. This episode really blurs the lines between lowercase family and uppercase family. Because it has this like this specific brand of organized crime, and maybe all organized crime has this like feudal, family-oriented, not even feudal, like tribal flavor to it. You can't help but put your relatives on all of these decisions.
Right.
Your cousins, your sons, your wives, whoever. And not only does it make the ultimate decisions you have to make about these people, if you're going to be in organized crime, that much more difficult, or maybe not at all. But there's all these like childhood dynamics. Like Tony's known Christopher since he was a baby, and Christopher's known Tony for his whole life. And just all the ways these like little interactions you would have had as a small child or a teenager or whatever that impact these business decisions that get made. Especially with who gets promoted, like would Tony be, and like with Christopher. Like Christopher takes everything that Tony does so personally.
Right. Yeah.
In a way that I don't know, like this isn't the show that I like it's most subtle with like the guy at the gas station. But I do think you have to believe, I think the show needs you to believe that Christopher is going to do it, is going to go with Adriana. Until he has this very surface level, because he's not a smart man, this very surface level realization at this gas station.
Right.
And then changes his mind. I remember seeing this episode and thinking that was the most genius fucking thing in the world. It is so obvious. But not in a bad way, I think. No. I don't know. Is it too on the nose? What do you think?
Like the fake outs? Or
not
like...
the fake out. We'll talk about the fake out. But that whole scene with Chris at the gas station. Like, is that like a first pass kind of thing? Like, let's find somebody who looks vaguely like Christopher who's eaten like too many Funyuns. And let's put Chris in a nice car and put them in a shitty car and give them a lot of kids who this guy does not care about.
It doesn't bother me. Like, okay. I love it. It's a good... But you gotta see what Christopher's seeing, I think. And it has to be a little more obvious. It's kind of hard to...
Sure.
It doesn't even mean the family actually look like that. That's how Christopher saw them that day.
Yeah.
Right? So he knew he didn't want to leave the life. Because him leaving that life meant that you were going to be unhappy.
Yeah. I think Chris is closer to AJ than he is to Tony in that... No, I think Christopher has more self-delusion than AJ does. I think AJ knows he does not get at anything, which is why he freaks out.
Yeah, like...
Okay. I think Christopher has some love... I think he can fool himself into thinking, I could do X, Y, Z.
He's like riding that Dunning-Kruger effect line, yes. Right?
Yeah.
He's right there in the middle of... Not smart enough to
realize. The whole finally write my memoirs. I do think he thinks he could do that.
Yeah.
He would desperately need a ghostwriter. And in fairness to Chris, he does get that movie made.
Yeah.
Later.
I mean.
Oh, there, a lot of movies are bad.
Right.
That's certainly true.
It has power.
He clearly had some influence over the script.
Yeah.
And the story of it. Stephen Baldwin. Really, really bringing it. Oh, I can't remember what he said exactly. God damn it. I gotta watch this whole fucking series again.
I know, this made me want to watch the whole thing too. This is so I'm rewatching Lost right now, and this is just a better show. Period.
I love
Lost. But this is just better all the way through.
Yeah. Chris in his head with that guy. Everything doesn't have to be subtle. I'm talking myself into liking the scene more again. I don't think Chris has to work very hard in his mind to be like, it would be very easy to turn into that guy without all this stuff, without all the structure of the organized crime, without these ends that
he's got. He's got his big, nice truck, too. He's sitting
Affectionate rub. We talked about Tony's talent with lying, arguably never been better than the phone call that he gives Adriana.
Yes.
You have to believe that it's real. And I think you do. I really want to say, in praise of the show, I really want to say that I did buy it. Like, holy shit. Now what?
Yeah.
Chris is trying to kill himself. Like, because it's plausible. Tony, it's a perfectly spun tale on his part, where he provides enough details on what's really happening that it might be true. Like the surreal, like the magical realism, like the fake out that the show does, really not subtle, but I think exactly right.
Have you ever listened to the lyrics of the song too?
Sure, yeah.
It's definitely not subtle, right?
No, like, not at all.
Getting
not
the car drive, whatever it was, yeah.
Like the transition from the fantasy where the music is, non-diegetic, I think. I can't ever remember that. Diegetic is if the music that the viewer is hearing is also being heard by the characters, I think.
Mm.
So non-diegetic, it's on the soundtrack.
Mm.
And then it switches to diegetic when she's in the car with Silvio. And just like this tinny car radio. And then the family, like Tony and Christopher and et cetera, they make real life look like her fantasy with like leaving her car in the long-term parking and packing up a suitcase and just throwing it away. Like she did actually just drive away and do that thing. They had more imagination ultimately than Adriana did. Which is like, one of her many fatal flaws.
Yeah.
I remember reading about this episode at the time and like her being this like sacrificial lamb or this like babe in the woods. She's just not.
Right. No, she knows what's going on.
She knows exactly what she's doing.
Yeah.
She's just dumb.
It doesn't make me feel any... I feel bad for her.
Of course.
Because she's just... you talk about the Dunning-Kruger effect. She's not even smart enough to know she's not.
At the same time, you don't get a sense that like Tony keeps a thin curtain, but a curtain between him and Carmela. Between like his work and his home. Christopher's not doing that.
No, he's not.
Christopher's coming home and he's debriefing. Like, this shit pissed me off today. I did this shit really well. She knows. She knows everything she could possibly know.
He's like
know.
The first millennial. The millennial soprano.
Christopher is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Overly emotional, takes everything personal, comes home, talks about work stuff you're not supposed to.
Yeah. You can't separate.
Respects,
there's no non-overlapping magisteria for Chris. Yeah. It's all the same shit. If this isn't still my favorite Sopranos episode, it is one of the better made ones, I think. No question. There are so many smart edits. Going from Chris throwing the wine into him venting at home and like skipping over the next several hours that were no doubt interesting. Like Christopher would have had to continue to like steam and stew at this dinner. That could very easily have been a scene, but like going from the throwing the wine to him with Adriana is great. It's so great. The fifth season I think is my favorite season.
It's great. Like you said, I need to go back and rewatch all of this.
I'm going to, yes.
Because I think I've watched this in full.
I haven't for a long time.
I think twice. I think I've only watched this twice.
Yeah, I don't think I couldn't even tell you the last time I did it. It might be more than a decade.
It's just tough to get through that first season sometimes, so.
Yeah. no question. Last thing to say about long-term parking. Sopranos is often the funniest show on TV, even in its darkest episode. Tony sheepishly saying it's the Hermes, in like he's a Muppet or something.
Yeah, it's supposed to be the best.
First of all, it's pronounced Hermes.
So great. I didn't even know that part.
I didn't realize that until I heard. I'm not super up on designer fashion. I had to hear someone say Hermes.
I'm like, what?
Of course Tony would say it that way. Yeah, what does he fucking know?
When we talk about the ineloquent, like, this is a perfect example of that. Because, it's the best. Like, a line that just did, in a popular television show, pop television, they would just be like, it's a Louis Vuitton.
Yeah.
You don't have to add it's the best. But, like, normal people, that is 100%
the most reliable joke in The Sopranos is characters saying words the wrong way.
Yes. It's so great.
We saw Big Carmine in Fortunate Son saying there's no stigmata these days. And we see his son in long-term parking in a den that he had built for this exact moment where he can sit with his snifter of cognac in front of a fireplace with his captains to his left and his right making important decisions.
He can't do it.
And he's not up to the moment because it's a fucking stagmire. Little Carmine was the best at that, but everybody's bad at words in The Sopranos.
And so, it's dumb people pretending to be smart.
Yes. It's the sacred and the profane. Side by side.
Speaking of dumb people pretending to be smart, Chris has that glass of wine. He just takes a big swig of it at one point and just puts his I took a fancy drink. It's not cold Stoli from the freezer.
Which, right? Let's be fair, delicious.
Yeah, absolutely. It looked, at least I saw him pull it out. I'm like, I want that.
Anything else that we missed about this episode or anything?
A couple other funny parts. Who'd ever say to their bride, There she is, my smelly Valentine.
It's really mean.
Because she's having stomach issues. She's
very mean. She is a complicit person. You do feel...
Yeah.
And the most important thing to her, and her mother, clearly, is how she looks.
Yeah.
You feel very bad for her when you, like, oh yeah, she's going to blow up.
Well, I think it's a reflection of fans as well, because that's all she... A lot of people ever treat her as fans, yeah, yeah. Right?
So, yes, and they were anxiously awaiting the moment when she would come back triumphant with fury when they rush in and take her revenge.
Yeah, I just...
Because she knows where all the bodies are buried. Yikes. Fans are stupid.
And the last part, again, another regular dialogue, when they found the body on the beach, the guy just says, "Don't touch it, Apprentice Delaney."
Like, very formal, I want to say beach rangers, whatever the New Jersey Boy Scouts is.
It was great, and just why did you name the character Apprentice Delaney?
I'm sure they poured over it all day in the writer's room.
It's so good. It's so perfect.
For our next quartet of episodes, we're going to talk about Lowercase Family, and we're going to discuss the episodes College in the first season, Proshai Lavushka in the third season, Whitecaps in the fourth season. We're going to return to the fifth season for Marco Polo. That is one of my stealth favorite episodes, Marco Polo. I had to get it in there. I had to cut other episodes that were probably more suited to this theme to talk about.
Well, we're here for fun.
Yes, exactly.
And to talk about Polly Walnuts with no shirt on.
I don't know that he's in any of these episodes. No. Oh, gosh, I don't think he is. I don't think he is.
Well,
that's difficult. That's difficult. Yeah. We'll have to make up for it in future episodes that will be themed towards the more trippier, like dream centered episodes the Sopranos did, and we have to talk about the bad episodes of the Sopranos too. Sometimes it dared to be bad. I don't think the bad episodes made it any worse. I think the bad episode is just the fact of like Chase's heritage in TV, where you have to write 24 episodes a season, and sometimes you're phone the fuck
this
in.
This too much.
Check us out on the internet at MutecaMovie.club. You can follow us on Facebook at MutecaMovieClub, on Twitter at MutecaMovieCole, and Instagram at MutecaMovieClub on Instagram. Thank you for joining me tonight, Shane.
Thanks, Sean.
Ugots.
Oh.
Have a good night.